This show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Services, Dr. Edward T. Buford, the Athletic Republic Capital Region, and In and Out of Sports. The Coach's Corner is powered by our partners at the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Well, folks, we have another good one for you in the Coach's Corner. We have one of the most prolific scorers in the history of high school basketball, not just in the DMV, but in the nation. He was known as the Magician, the Shootist, JoJo, Anthony JoJo Hunter. Hey, Joe, how are you, man?
How
welcome
you?
To In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner, my man.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be on another one of your shows. And you sure, get all the best guys in the city to be on this show. And Adrian was the first one on the show. I enjoyed hearing that. And thanks for having me on. I'm glad to be in the company of somebody like Adrian Dantley.
Well, you've always been in high cotton in terms of great players. But let's start off and let some of our listeners know, may not be aware, when I first met you, you were a freshman, Anthony Hunter, and then all of a sudden
right.
folks started calling you JoJo. How did that come about?
Well, the mentor that I had that was intact with a guy who ran a camp called Five-Star Basketball Camp, and the guy's name was Howard Garfinkel.
Mm-hmm.
And, some of the former announcers, some of the announcers today were counselors like Hubie Brown, Alligator, who is Mike Fratello, one of the former coaches. They were counselors there. And, my game kind of, I guess, registered to them as JoJo White. And, I shot a good backboard shot. I had, a medium bush. And back that time, JoJo White and I had almost the same style game. So Howard Garfinkel said that my game was similar to his, and the name kind of stuck.
Wow.
So when I came back that summer, Anthony was gone and JoJo was in.
No question about it. And see, you are of iconic status when people can recognize you by just one name, like Prince and Michael. JoJo. All right, JoJo, a little known fact, because I know and, I go back with you like Cadillac Seats with Ed Myers and Jay Shorter and people like that. But
right.
You started your first sport of choice was boxing. Talk
right.
about that.
Right. Well, I was really fascinated with Reuben Hurricane Carter, who Muhammad Ali was a good friend of his, and Muhammad Ali. I came up during the time when Sugar Ray was getting his notoriety at Fentley's Gym. Roger Leonard also was a guy that, I watched. So boxing was something that didn't have a team involved. So I was more into the individual sport. I love tennis. I watch Roger Federer and Djokovic, and I like watching the sports that you really can't blame it on nobody else. You have to be ready, when the time comes. So I ventured into that sport over at number 11's Boys Club for maybe a couple of months, and I had a nosebleed that I used to get during the fights and after the fights, and I messed up so many T-shirts, bleeding, going home, that my mom said, we got to find another sport. So I ended up playing football, and they was hitting hard. I was on offense. I wanted to play defense to kind of get back a little bit, but my defensive skills for football wasn't all that great, I guess, because I never got on defense. So I ended up playing basketball, which was a sport that, you stayed on the court on offense, and you definitely was on the court for the defense. So it was a attack and revenge, type of thing. And
grounds. And I know you have a special interest in keeping the history and legacy of playgrounds alive. Let's talk a little bit about D.C. area playgrounds, Luzon, Turkey Thicket, I mean, Taft, you go on and on. Rose Park, I mean, Langley. Talk about playgrounds and the playground of your choice back in the 70s.
Well, first of all, I have a book that I'm almost finished with that talks about the D.C. playgrounds and the legends. And Ed Myers, at this time, like I say, was my mentor, took me to most of these playgrounds, even though I lived right near Edgewood. I lived right down the street from Langley, which were the two courts that I honed my skills on or got started. My book is about, and my past is about all these playgrounds. And the reason why I was interested in writing this, because most of these playgrounds have changed, and we have forgotten a lot of players that helped me to be good, as well as players that didn't get the notoriety that I got that was just as good.
Such as.
Okay. That's Apple Malum, Michael Tucker, Kevin Tatum, Bozard, Steve Higgins, JoJo Hicks.
Steve, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Raymond Lee.
Yeah.
You know, I could go on.
Yeah.
Emmanuel Hardy, who played with me.
That's
Jimmy
right.
Jimmy Wright, who passed. Percy White, I thought was a great player that played at the Mather.
Big Percy. Tony
Ellis. Steve Lincoln was a great defensive player at Eastern and went on to play at Villanova with the Heron brothers, who I played with. So I could go on, Dave Revis. I could go on with the names on Carl Holmes, a guy who I thought was a phenomenal player, great attitude towards the game, and to this day you never hear anybody talk about it. He was a force. Kenny Carr.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
You know, not taking away nothing from Adrian, not taking away from nothing from nobody else. He was a force to be on the court with. One of my favorite players, who I thought was a gentle giant, and he's passed away, Sid Catmett.
Oh yeah.
You know, he was a big figure up at Edgewood. You had a guy named Kenny Pindell who used to play up at Edgewood, who passed a while back. Was a great player. Nene Hughes from the Hughes brother, who's lived right over here by Edgewood. He just passed just recently. Was a great playground player. Then you had a guy named Playground who played at Cardoza.
Joe, of all of the great nicknames, all of the great nicknames, Chicken Breast and Graveyard,
Superman Sims.
Yeah, but the best nickname, what is the guy you just said, Playground. Doesn't get any better
playground
than that. Yes.
And the thing about it, he was a playground legend. And,
yeah.
And people don't talk about it. Raymond Lee was another one. You know. So getting back to just talking about playgrounds, Edgewood, you had Hines, you had Sherwood, you had Tucker Road, you had Petworth, you had New Jersey Avenue. You had Edgewood, who we just mentioned. You had Turkey Thicket. I got a book with maybe about 30 playgrounds, and I'm not finished yet, because what I'm doing is naming the playgrounds and putting the players who represented the playgrounds and what they're doing, what colleges they went to, and hopefully quotes about what the playground did for them in their lives as they continue to live now. So it's been Langdon Park. You had Delonte Taylor. You had Skip McDaniels, Eddie Jordan, Tim Bassett, Jeffrey Harrison, Bozard, Lonnie Perrin. All them guys played over there. And if you lost, you might as well just take your shoes off and watch the rest of the game.
That's right. JoJo Hunter. JoJo Hunter is in the coach's corner. And JoJo, you go to Mackin. And talk about that experience as a young player. When you initially selected Mackin, were you aware of the great history and legacy of basketball, especially at the guard play that Mackin had?
Well, I was only looking at Mackin at this particular time because the name that came to me was Austin Carr. I didn't really know about Tom Little until later, you know. And Austin Carr was when I thought of Mackin, I thought about Austin Carr. And there have been so many other players that I didn't get a chance to. Later on, I got a chance to know that they went there. But for me, and you know, they said Austin Carr. When you say DeMatha, during the time when I was coming up, you thought about Adrian. You thought about Carlos Jones. You thought about Bob Whitmore. You thought about Sid Catlett, Kenny Roy. What's the guy that I just met that went to DeMatha? Everybody say he was a great player. I don't want to say Fred Hetzel because I don't know if he went to DeMatha.
Fred Hetzel attended Landon, and of course, Carlos Jones attended St. John's. But as you stated, DeMatha had so many great players. I mean, on and on. However, this is what I tell people in the DMV and across the nation. I don't believe you can point to any school in this country that has produced better backcourt players than Mackin. As you stated, you start with a Tom Little, then an Austin Carr, and then a JoJo Hunter, and then a Johnny Dawkins, a Duck Williams, a Kenny Payne. I mean, you know, Dominique Presley.
Yeah, very Keith Harwell.
Yeah, very few schools can match that legacy. But talk about your early days at Mackin as a freshman, and your transition from junior varsity to varsity.
Well, this is what happened. When I first got there, you know, you had the JV and the freshman team had an abundance of talent where people were going to, each year or so, was going to move up in the rankings to become a varsity player. So when I first came there, I was playing with Harry Falenza, and I was on the freshman team. And I played three games on the freshman team. I was averaging 35 points a game. And that was kind of, you know, phenomenal for somebody to come in and was averaging that many points at that level, because the Mapple always had a good freshman team, which was consisted of Hawkeye and Tony Ellis. Joe Washington, you know, was on the freshman team. Then after about three games, Mr. Jarrell, who was another mentor and a great assistant coach up in Mackin, he moved
Jarrell
me up to the – yeah, Jarrell Robinson. He moved – rest in peace. He moved me up to the to the junior varsity. And I played on the junior varsity for maybe two games. And then as a freshman, I think Adrian Daly is the only person that started his career as a freshman and started on a varsity team. I played DeMatha at St. John's, and we had a starting five that was just as big as the Knicks. We had Dave Reavers, who was 6'5", Duck Williams, who was 6'3", Larry Long was 6'6", the Heron brothers, Larry was 6'8", and Keith was 6'6". This was the starting five at a high school team.
That's right.
And we went down to the locker room, and they were warming up. Somehow or another, Joe Gallagher got the information that Dave Reavers was too old. And the game started, and they stopped Dave from playing. So they started a guy named Greg Leonard.
Yes.
And the ball went up down the court maybe two or three times, and Kenny Roy and Billy Langer was trapping Greg, who was only about 5'6", 5'7". Kenny Roy was 6'1", and Billy Langer was 6'3". So Mr. Harry Ress, who was the coach of the team, told Eddie Myers to come downstairs, and I was in the shower, and told me to suit up for the varsity team. And all they wanted me to do was just get the ball down the court and get it to the rest of the guys who were on my team, who were the big-time players at that time, Keith, Larry Long, and Larry Heron. And I already knew the plays because after we used to practice, I used to play with these guys. After practice, we used to just choose and play, so I was familiar with what they were running, what they was doing. And I got to start I came in and replaced Greg and helped him to get the ball, helped Duck and Keith to get the ball down the court. And from there, I was a varsity player. I was one of the first. I think Adrian was the first, but I think I was the second player to come in as a freshman to start on a varsity team as a ninth grader.
JoJo, you were a prolific scorer. And I've always said that obviously you have to have great talents and a great skill set to be a prolific scorer. But it's a little more than that. Along with that, you have to have that mindset. Talk about the components of being a prolific scorer, a guy like we used to say on the playground, no conscience.
Well, you get this kind of conscience from practice. And practicing by yourself, as I did so many days and nights, you know, I picked my spots. It wasn't no three-point shooting then, so everything was mid-range. So, I practiced with myself and shots that I always wanted to hit in the games. And just fortunately, God blessed me to put me in some of these spots to hit these shots. So to become a scorer, that mentality comes from practice. To become a great shooter, you have to know that every shot that I put up, I'm trying to hit it. So the key to it is trying to get to these spots and trying to get the right trajectory on the shot, you know, because once you become a scorer, people are always designed to try to make you do something different. Now, you all say I was a prolific scorer. I say I was a scorer and a shooter because – you know, there were some times when guys checked me that were bigger than me that I had to take what they gave me. And that was through shooting. You know, when I got to college, I had guys like Billy Bryant, Turk Tillman, my best friend Ernie Graham, who was 6'8". Yeah. I couldn't really just score over top of these guys like I wanted to. I had to shoot the balls in areas that they didn't think that I would shoot, which opened the game up for me, you know, stop and pop and free throw shots, top of the key. So I honed my skills after watching people like Sweet Lou Hudson, who was a great shooter, Walt Frazier, and one of my friends who, to this day, I don't think he knows that I kind of padded my shot a little bit after him, even though we played against each other a few times and we've seen each other. I've never mentioned it. Phil Chenier.
Yeah.
You know, He, I thought, was one of the great shooters. Another guy who was unsung and didn't get all the publicity. But when I used to go see Phil play, you know, it was he used to rise on the shot. Sweet Lou Hudson had the great trajectory to a shot. And Walt Frazier thought that every shot that he shot was mid-range and it was going in. So using all three of them guys, I kind of found my game with them using their techniques and their mindset.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the sake of some of our younger listeners or people who are a little older and may have been away in college or not following high school ball in the 70s when you played, let's give our listeners an example of how prolific of a scorer you were. I remember three examples. One game against McNamara, 57 points. Now, folks, that's 57, 5-7 without the three-point line. And as JoJo just stated, he was a jump shooter as well. So, Joe, I'm saying conservatively, that 57 with the three-point arc could have easily have been 65 or 70. Agree?
Agree, okay. But there's a key to that.
Okay.
There's a key to anybody that's scoring, and I can say that because we got one of the great NBA scorers who you had on the first show, and I'm gonna use him as my example. Okay,
right.
Everybody in the league, everybody on the team knew that certain spots that you gave Adrian the ball, and we played at least 12 years together down at the Urban Coalition, and I was sold on the same thing everybody else. If you gave Adrian the ball 4 or 5 steps away from the free throw line and you cleared it out for him, he was either going to get a bucket or he was going to go to the free throw line.
That's right.
With me, with my teammates, Emmanuel Hardy, Mo Young, the Twins, Jimmy Wright, Spooter Williams, when I was in high school. When we were running on the floor, they knew to get the ball to me early. And I can't take the – I take the credit of hitting the shots. I take the credit of shooting the balls.
Mm-hmm.
But they get the credit of getting me the ball where I was most effective. Man, for that night at McNamara, I can say, rest in peace, Jimmy Wright accounted for at least 25 of them points because he was getting steals, and he would always look back to see where I was. So I can't take the credit of getting 57. I take the credit of being on a team that knew that if they got me the ball at the right spots, that I could score. See, you know, a lot of times, you know, you look at George Gervin, you look at Adrian Dantley, you look at David Thompson, you look at Dr. J. Dr. J didn't have a jump shot. He led the league in scoring. You know the reason why? Fatty Taylor, who is also a Washington player, got
right.
him the ball in stride where he knew that he was at his best. And to this day, I don't think people really know how great Dr. J was, and I don't think people know how great Adrian was. Because if you see Adrian in person, you won't believe that he led the league in scoring 3 or 4 years. I practiced with him for 7 years playing full court one-on-one. He was strong, but his game was getting to his spots. And once he got to his spots, whether you was 6'9", 6'10", or 6'3", like I am, you couldn't stop him.
Mm-hmm.
I used to beat Adrian on my speed and get to my spot. He beat me on power and position. It's
mm-hmm.
just two different things, but this is what you have to do. Have you coming up in this basketball thing today? LeBron James, you get the ball to him in the right spot, he's going to play good. My favorite player of the league is Carmelo Anthony and Westbrook. Carmelo, if you get it to him on that shoulder, I don't think he's at his best. You know, stop and pop. Westbrook's, you know, he mid-range, one of the best mid-range players in a long time since, I would say, Randy Smith, you know. So
yeah.
that would sum it up for me as far as that question that you asked, Butch.
And then also with the 57, and always tease our good friend who is a really good ball player in his own right and an excellent coach, Todd Bozeman. You know, you had 57, and the entire McNamara team, I think, had what, 54?
No, they had 56.
They had 56. So you outscored the whole team. Now, Joe, the other awesome display of scoring was in the Alhambra tournament, the old Cumberland tournament. In three games, you had over 130 points. Three games, man.
And that was a lot of balls I shot. And I go back to my teammates. They all look for me. And I think from how they look for me, all them guys got Division I scholarships. That record still stands up there, Cumberland. And, you know, once you get into a groove with a team, you know, click. And the only way things can click is you practice and people get to know, where to get the ball. And I haven't played with Adrian in a while, you know, or guys like Kenny Carr or Billy, Ernie Graham. I haven't played, you know, we haven't played together because everybody's careers are over. But right now, in my mind, I know where to get Ernie the ball at.
Sure.
I know where to get Adrian the ball. So this is what happened during the times. I've had some I never forget I was in college and we played Oklahoma. And they had some great players down there. And I had 2 points in the first half. And, you know, they were playing some great defense. I couldn't get to my spots because they was playing a matchup zone. Second half, they came out of the zone. I scored 25 points in the second half. And we beat them on the road. Something that, you know, school hasn't been able to do. And it's been like that for many years. This is through practice. You know, if you're going to be a great reader, you got to read. If you're going to be whatever you're going to be in life, you know, you need practice. And that's what I did to kind of hone my skills to be able to shoot and score like I did.
You're listening to JoJo Hunter in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams in and out of sports. And JoJo, you cannot talk basketball in JoJo Hunter without mentioning, you know, there's an old saying, Joe, that behind every great champion, there is a great opponent, a great rival, a great adversary. You know, Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and your great rival and adversary, athletically, basketball-wise, was Hawkeye Whitney. Talk about the legendary night, St. John's, the Mather versus Mackin, a shootout on a basketball court, and I'm talking jump shots now, folks. JoJo Hunter, Hawkeye Whitney. Take us through that night, Joe.
Okay, this started with us, in June of the summer of 75. I went to a basketball camp the first 2 weeks, and I think Hawk came the second 2 weeks. And Howard Garfinkel, you know, in his book he had back then, made a statement that he couldn't wait to see me and Hawkeye play against each other because we both had made it to a level where, you know, we could kind of carry our teams and we both had good teams. So that year when the Math and Mackin was going to play at St. John's, the anticipation of the game was like Notre Dame playing UCLA, the Lakers playing Boston, and this was at the high school level. And Hawkeye was at the peak of his game. I was at the peak of my game. My team was playing well. His team was playing well. Both coaches had an attitude to win. The fans in the city, I thought D.C. at this time was just phenomenal with all the games that they participated in and went to. From even when I wasn't playing, I couldn't wait to get over to see Dunbar play, see Stacy and Bebe play, and go see Cricket and them play up at Easton and Mack and Ratchiff and Rodney Wright. So when I came in the gym that night, like 2,000 people in there. We couldn't get in the gym. We had to, you know, fight our way to get in. You know, Hawkeye then was out first warming up. Me and him met at half court, and, you know, he looked at me and said, have a good one, this and that. Hawkeye scored 41 points. I scored 39. The second quarter of that game, me and Hawkeye must have traded maybe 3 or 4 buckets back-to-back where my team was going to me, they was going to him. And Hawkeye was 6'5", so I was playing the 2 guard, but at this time I had like a 38-inch vertical, so I used to come down and try to help them with Hawkeye. But he was so strong and so big and so agile that once he got up over top of you, it was curtains. I mean, the Mather had some great athletes. I mean, you look at these guys body-wise, Hawkeye, Adrian, Kenny Carr. I mean, these guys were what's the guy from Duke, what's his name, Zion? They was like that in high school.
That's right.
You know, so, I always tried to come down and help. I could jump then, so every time I went to the basket in this particular game, Hawkeye would be right there to either try to block a shot or make me alter my shot. And we made each other better. Our teams played to the apex. It was a great game. When the game was over, Morgan came over and said, you know, he had did his homework to try to stop me as well as we did with Hawkeye. But it got to the point where let these two guys get their points and stop everybody else, you know. And, you know, they end up beating us. Great game. I think everybody got their money's worth. The fans on the outside was every time they opened the door, they rushed the door to get in. So it was great. I mean, basketball – at that time at the fan level and people's parents was involved and the coaches, it was just phenomenal. It was a night to remember and a night to be talking about today for the new guys that's coming up to make their chances greater because they got a chance right now to do the same thing and make it even greater.
No question.
So it was a great night.
All right. Now next, JoJo, folks, 1976, this was a time where the NBA, if you were considering coming out of high school, you had to be at least 6'7 or above. Daryl Dawkins, big man. Bill Willoughby, big man. Spencer Haywood, Moses Malone. But JoJo Hunter was being courted heavily and scouted heavily by the Philadelphia 76ers. Joe, I always ask you this question. What happened and why didn't you make that decision? Man, I know I'm not ready. I know I have a lot of work. But if y'all want me, you got me.
Well, at that time, it was just so much. I had over 500 schools recruiting me. I used to get boxes of letters every day. I got stuff under the table. Me and Eddie Myers went to the coach. And, you know, $50,000 in the 70s was $1 million. You know, I got offered so much. And then here comes Gene Shue coming to practice and wanted to court me to come to Philadelphia. And the 76ers was getting ready to employ some of the players from the ABA, you know, Dr. J, a few other players. It was a time in my life that I was at the apex of what I was doing, playing basketball. And I had Eddie Myers there. I had Michael Jordan's famous agent, David Falk. Man, I just looked at, here's the book that David Falk, I just picked it up. Here's a book that David Falk just wrote. I just had a meeting with him not too long ago about something else. It's called The Bold Truth by David Falk. And this is what he wrote. A true legend, dear JoJo, a true legend. The first ever one and done until you met a conservative lawyer in D.C. Now, when he's saying conservative lawyer, he meant that he didn't know if he wanted me to go or not because it was almost like I was a shoe-in to go even if I went to 1 year in college and went in the draft. He said, I respect your attitude about sharing your life lessons with young people. This is a true gift. Always shoot for the stars, David Falk. That's what he put in his book. And during this time, it was me, my mom, Eddie Myers, Will Jones, and David Falk. And I played in the Capital Classic, which was the last game I played before I made my decision. I had also, and I'm one of the first guys out of high school who got invited to the Olympics in 1970 when the Olympics was very big with all the players in the NBA and before they started picking up a college player to play on their team. I thought at that time, Butch, that I thought I was ready and I thought I wasn't ready. I went to Maryland to see George McGinnis and spoke with him. He informed me to, you know, try to get all the money I could get, make sure I got some educational bonuses because I was young. I seen how big these guys was, which I had already played against guys like Kenny Carr and Adrian. They couldn't get no bigger. But these guys were professionals. And, you know, when I look back on it, I should have went. But then, you know, I think I still did the right thing. You know, I went to college. Maryland had 20 games. This was during the time. Will Jones, during this time when I was making my decision, he was a friend of me and Eddie Myers, and then he became the assistant coach at Maryland. So he was selling Maryland, and I had to make a decision with the Sixers. And I went with Maryland, you know, because if 20 games on Channel 20, I was sold on the fact that, hey, man, you're going to be remembered. You're going to be close right here in D.C. where your mother and father can see you play. They can come to the games. Maryland was, you know, and it was great. They had John Lucas, all these great guys. Guys was going to the pros. And I just thought, in my mind, one and done, and I was going, you know, transition to the next level.
But, Joe, here's the issue as a former coach, high school coach. And I would never tell a player where to go. I would advise him, but it was ultimately his decision as well as his family.
Hello?
But here's Joe. Are you still with us, JoJo? Okay, I hope we didn't lose it.
I'm here.
Okay, great. Fantastic. This is what I would always advise. Go to a school that has a program that will allow you to play the same way or very similar the way you played in high school. That wasn't possible in Maryland. Because they had too many
You know what? This is the reason why I transferred. I thought
that from my conversation with Lefty, I thought that he recruited me for the style and what I brought to the game.
Okay.
Once I got there, I was second fiddle to Steve Shepard because he went to the Olympics that year. And we had a discussion, you know, me, you know, I think a couple games, and I got kind of frustrated. It was me, Brad Davis, Steve Shepard, and Lefty. And I've never discussed this because I don't never want to say nothing bad about Lefty because he gave me a chance to, you know, go to a major school. And yeah, people know me now from playing at Maryland. And I say the same thing about Mr. Horton. He gave me a chance when I came home from my mistake.
Sure.
He gave me a job. You know, we have other issues, but he gave me a job when no one else will. So I always honor that.
That's
right. You know, but Lefty recruited me to score. And when I got there, he had a structured offense. And his first option was to get Steve Shepard the ball to get him in the league. But in this discussion, I said, okay, you giving Shep the ball to get him in the league, which sacrificed the team somewhat, because you had other people that could score. Lawrence Boston could score. Larry Gibson could score with his back to the basket. Brad Davis was probably one of the best point guards that I had ever played with because he knew where to get you the ball, and he was a great player, loved the game. And I couldn't ask for a better player when he did get the ball to me. But he was trying to get Steve Shepard in. I was next. But here's what I said in the meeting. I said, well, I could have went without even coming here. And I could have went to that same Olympic team that he was on 1976 with Quinn Buckner, Scott May, Adrian Dantley. I could have been on that team as well because they wanted me. Bobby Knight was the coach who also was recruiting me for Indiana. So I was plugged in a little bit to you know, even be there and use that as a bouncing rod to say I played in the Olympics or whatever. But David Falk told me after the Capital Classic, don't play in anything else. Let's sit down and see what you're going to do, if you're going to go, where you're going to go. And my schools were, at this time, was Rutgers with Tom Young, UCLA, South Carolina with was it Coach Frank Robinson, UCLA, who else? Notre Dame. And I had spoke with Adrian during that time, and Adrian said he was going. You know, he didn't say don't come up here, but he said I'm going to the league. He was going harsh in his junior year. And it was a host of other schools, you know, North Carolina, mm-hmm. Dean Smith, and Will recruited me, and Lefty came with a good pitch, and I came to Maryland. You know, I got 40 games on Channel 20. Holly Farms,
sure.
You know, was involved with it, and it was great. But he changed my game. It took me to a structure. Most of the shots I shot at Maryland were shots from the spots that I had practiced that wasn't in his offense. Because a lot of times Lefty would, when I would go up on shots, he would almost like saying, no, 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 it's a bad shot. But then with the ball go in, he would put his hands up like it was a play call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll never forget this. And a lot of these things, I'm talking about it now because it's time to talk about it. I never forget we was playing UNLV, and they had Reggie Theus and all these Jackie Robinson, had all these great players. We was down by 21 at halftime. So me and Albert King, another New York star, we walking towards the locker room. So I said, why he won't let us play freelance like they don't? They freelance, they playing, just playing playground basketball. We was down 21. So not knowing him, Lefty, Will Jones, and Joe Harrington was behind us. So he said, son, we're going to run what I'm going to run. I've never had a player that, you know, questioned what we're doing, whatever. So we're going to the locker room. So Albert, he asked him, what's going on with the morale team? So Albert stepped up and said, Coach, won't you let us just play back? Let's do motion offense, which was an offense that we did run. So we go out second half. They score again. We're down 23. Lefty calls time up. So he said, this is the first time I'm going to go against my coaching staff, which is Will and Joe Harrington, and I'm going to let you guys play motion. At the end of the game, I had the most points I scored at Maryland, which was 27. I scored 27. Albert scored 23, and I think Ernie came in and got 15.
Wow.
And we beat them by 7. The next day, me and Albert was in Lefty's office saying that don't embarrass him by, you know, going against what he did or whatever. So as I'm walking off the court the night before this meeting, Jerry Todd Canyon says to me, you know, we take transfer. You don't look like you're happy.
Park.
When the time came, I said I was going to transfer. I went out there. And just unfortunately, Sidney Green took a car. You know, the alumni was involved with their program, wrecked it in Detroit, left the car. NCAA found out that it's a car that's given to a player, which was against the NCAA. That car was taken away. Scholarship was taken away that was going to be awarded to me. And I ended up staying out there that summer. And I lived in the Flamingo Hotel, which is the Bellagio right now. And I worked for Dean Martin, flipping lights to pay for my summer school and to play for the upcoming year of me being a transfer student as a redshirt.
Wow.
I got tired of it. I came home. I'm on the plane. I walked through the plane. I'm in first class. And summer was over. Told Talk that I would make a decision on what I was going to do. I walked through there. Who do I see? Larry Brown, who was the coach of the Denver Nuggets. And we talked. He said, why you don't go to North Carolina? I said, well, Lefty won't, you know, will not sign the interstate agreement. And, you know, any coach wouldn't want a player to go to another school and you got to play against them. So he was going to send me wherever. So he said, I had a friend out here named Bill Blair. They already had Tony Ellis and Joe Washington out there, and me and Justin came later, and a guy named Russell Turney. And I ended up in Colorado. I got out there, hung out with Alvin Gentry, who is the coach of the Pelicans right now, who is David Thompson's cousin. I got to hang out with David. Fatty Taylor was the figurehead of the town. Denver is a beautiful place. And it was a football school that was enhancing the other programs. I came along when the Colorado program was doing well, and that's how I ended up with Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, JoJo Hunter is in the coach's corner. And, JoJo, we've got about 10 minutes left, man. This is some great stuff. But you go to the Milwaukee Bucks camp. You spend some time there, and you play overseas. Talk about that.
I played with Milwaukee. I was on the team for a minute. And Marcus Johnson's daughter died in the swimming pool. That at this time, they didn't have the covers over the pools, and she slid down. And I made the team. And, you know, back then, all the NBA teams were like four guards, two-point guards, two shooting guards. You had a guy like Junior Bridgman who could play the one, two, and the three, and you had the five forwards and the two centers. So when Marcus said he wanted to get traded to the Lakers where his daughter had died because he was spending time out there wanting to trade him, I'm coming down the elevator, and me and Alton Liston were the two guys that made the team that year from the draft. I'm coming down the steps, and who do I see coming up the elevator? I knew we didn't have a game, which was Bobby Dandridge.
Mm.
He was coming up the elevator. He said, hey, Joe, what's happening? I said, what you doing? He said, boy, they brought me in. So they brought Bobby in to replace Marcus Johnson. And that's how I was released. And I stayed out there for like 2 weeks, and Don Nelson got me a job in Spain. I went to Spain that summer, and I came back. I tried out with the Bullets. We had won the championship down at the Urban Coalition. The Bullets invited me to their basketball camp. I got cut again. Played 5 years in the CBA. Got picked up once by Detroit. And then it was getting late, so I ended up going overseas. I played Israel, I played in Belgium, I played in Brussels, I played in the Philippines, I played in Mexico, I played 4 years in South America. Where else? I said Belgium and Brussels.
Well, that,
and
that,
the Philippines.
Yeah. Let me ask
so
you this question.
I played like
10
years
question.
Overseas, and then I came home.
Joe, let me ask you this quick question. People listening
okay.
are saying, wow. As great of a player as JoJo Hunter was, and he got cut. JoJo, was it back then, you know, they had a lot of no-cut contracts. And
exactly, that was one reason.
And some cases, quotas. or was it something on your game that you need to or should have improved on? As you see it now, why was the reason why JoJo Hunter did not play in the NBA?
Well, it's a numbers game, and these things go on now. I'm going to give you a perfect example. The guy who was just at Maryland, he was a great player. What's the guy's name? Tribble?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, at Maryland, he was a pure point guard. And he go to, you get drafted by a team where he was more of a combo guard, but he was a small guard. I was a scorer in college. I led the Big Eight 2 years in scoring against Renaldo Blackman and Donnell Valentine, John Sunvold, and all that. And some of my great games was against Renaldo Blackman, who was 6'6". I also played against Walter Davis. I played against great players. Well, when I got to the pro level, they had Quinn Buckner, Bryant Williams, Cindy Moncrief, Junior Bridgman, myself, and Ricky Davis. And I think for that particular team, they wanted me to be a point guard. But I was a point guard who was in a combo type of position. And the team that I thought that was going to pick me, I thought Larry Brown was going to pick me for the Nuggets because I was in the papers just as much as the Nuggets was in Denver. And after I stayed on the team with Milwaukee for a minute, Denver couldn't pick me up because it was beyond the they had a deadline. Once you got cut, and it was beyond deadline, you had to go to the CBA of the team that you were selected to. And I was selected after the fact of the deadline, so I went overseas to play. But it's all about what team you go to, because I was going to be transferred as far as my talent as a guard who could shoot the ball. I'm going to tell you who I would have been playing like a Brian Davis. That's what they was trying to get me to do. I'm also can look to get somebody in the game, but I'm also looking to score. It was many times where Don Nelson would call a play and say, three down, which was for Bob Lanier. And you're looking at the clock up there, 24 seconds, and I pass it in to Bobby and got him to throw it back out. It's 8-9 seconds to go. So my instincts as a two guard just comes into play. I'm looking to shoot after that. Ain't nobody else going to get it. I'm going to put it up. I did that several times, and he called timeout and say, you got plenty of time to get a reentry, like throw it back into somebody. You had Mickey Johnson. You had Pat Cummins. We had Lynn Elmore, who's a former Maryland player on the team. So it was about the team I went to, and it was about the contracts.
Okay.
So I got cut. And back then, you got to look at it. It was an abundance of great college players.
Wow.
Not taking nothing away from these young guys today. These guys went to school for 4 years to prepare to get in the NBA. Now, these guys are not really prepared for me to come and watch because their skills are not, that honed. If you go to school 3 years and you're working on your game in college and come to the pros, you're ready. But I don't see many guys going 1 year, one and done, and they go right to the pros because you're going to sit on the bench, number one. Number two, you could be playing in college, but they're going to get the money. They're going to get the money and secure themselves. So I was good enough to play because when you talk about the guys that played here in this urban coalition, I was right there with him. I'm pretty sure if you asked Adrian, could I play in the league, he would say, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
If you asked Larry Wright, if you asked Ricky Sobers, these are guys I played against. You asked Ricky Sobers, you asked Tom Bosworth, all of the Nuggets. If you asked David Thompson right now, could I play in the league, he would say, yeah, because I played against him.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say Adrian because we played against each other every day, full court, one-on-one. But the basketball still took me to places that I wouldn't have been able to go. So I was a pro overseas, and I got paid to play. Just fortunately, I got to meet good people. I have nothing to be ashamed of because without the sport, I wonder where JoJo Hunter would have been then. The sport has been definitely good for me, and I hope the sport does the same thing for some of these other young guys. Get your education, meet people, and try to be a good person.
JoJo, we've got 2 minutes left. I always had the ultimate respect and admiration. I met you when you were in Mac, and I was a young coach. You were always so respectful towards me. But having said that, I have even more respect for you as a man. It's documented as your greatness on the court. After basketball, you had some twists and some turns. But, man, you have rebounded, and not only have you rebounded, but you have been an example going around talking to young people and trying to guide them in the right direction. A minute left. Please fill in the blanks.
Well, I'm always going to be an example because I try to be an example that, you know, a man that falls down and get back up is really a person that I admire. You know, I have my ups and downs now, you know, throughout my personal life, but I'm always a fighter. You know, every time Adrian scored on me, I tried my best to go down and try to score on him. So going to prison and not making the NBA are things that I did them 100%. I did all I could when I went into prison to get out. Now I'm out. I want to use my story to be an example to someone else to say, hey, it's a better way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I made an example. And I'm glad to be in this position. I hope that someone is listening that could get me in a position where I could talk to more kids because these kids today are out of control.
Yeah.
You know, I think the older people that's here in this town shouldn't be scared to go to the store or shouldn't be scared because they're shooting in these areas or this and that because you're doing something that's already been done and it's a better way, it's a positive way to get the attention that I think that these guys are looking forward to.
Absolutely.
You know, and if someone is listening where I could come into these schools and talk to some of these kids or at some of these kids at these juvenile facilities, I would love to do it because I don't have nothing to hide. My life is an open story.
Absolutely, and folks, I've heard him speak none better. JoJo, this has been fantastic, man. Always, always one of my favorite people. I'm always in your corner. When you're in the battle, I'm one of your cut men, along with Jay Shorter and Eddie Myers. Thanks a lot, my friend.
I got one more last thing to say, Butch.
Real quick.
I'll see you on Georgia Avenue as you continue to be in shape as well. I always continue to blow the horn at you.
My man, thank you. And, folks, that was the iconic, the legendary Anthony JoJo Hunter. Now, we've got a couple minutes left, and so I have to bring on tomorrow. We're all excited about the documentary Basketball County in the Water. And we have the director and the producer of this wonderful masterpiece aboard. John Beckham, how are you?
Coach, how are you today?
All right. Well, let's get to it. Man, let our listeners know what can they expect tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Showtime.
9 p.m. Showtime tomorrow. You can expect a documentary about where many of us are from. We tell the story of how basketball came to Washington, D.C., how people migrated out into this wonderful county called Prince George's County and started to build what has become a basketball hotbed. It tells the stories of many significant figures. Not all the stories. We couldn't fit it all in. But it tells a bunch of really heavy and good stories of basketball and why this area has become so special.
And when they watch this, what do you think they're going to walk away with and say, wow, you know what? I didn't know that.
I think the story of E.B. Henderson is something that people are going to have their eyes open to that they might not have had before. The story of a guy who studied under James Naismith for a summer and then came back home to Washington, D.C. and, you know, was then called the godfather of black basketball because he spread it around to the 12th Street YMCA in D.C. and that's kind of where basketball started for in this area. And I don't think he's gotten enough recognition, and hopefully this movie helps change that.
And I think that's one that's my piece in terms of talking about Dr. Henderson. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we'll see Coach Butch McAdams tomorrow talking about EB and a little bit of kind of where the game started for the area. And, you know, I've been talking to Coach 3 years now about this piece, and, you know, we're both in agreement, and I think everybody is that, you know, you can't talk about Prince George's County basketball without talking about Washington, D.C.
And that's tomorrow, folks, 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Showtime. It's must watch. And, hey, John, thanks a lot, my man.
Coach, thank you.
All right. And I tell you, I've had a ball. Hope you enjoyed the show. And this is one of many, many more to come. The legends will be in the coach's corner. And I want to thank our sponsors, Horton's Funeral Service. For over 80 years, they're just the very best in family funeral care. If your family is in any need of funeral services, 202-829-9000 and ask for Randolph Horton, Reds Bowman, my brother. Also, for some excellent dental care, it is Dr. Edward T. Buford. Dr. Buford, boy, you know what? He's just simply the best in terms of getting your teeth right. And he's located 1209 U Street, Washington, D.C., right next to Ben's Chili Bowl. And then that number is 202-667-8818. And when this pandemic ends, it is the Athletic Republic. They're located at 6417 District Heights, Maryland. District Heights, Maryland on Marlboro Pike. And I want to thank my producer, just a great guy, the editor of the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, my man, Ricky Hampton Sr. Without him, I could not do this show. But I want to thank you guys for listening in. So, hey, next time, we'll promise we'll be even better than today. But in the meantime, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. Rob?
It's funny to me because I want to get every little
second out.
Yeah.
So I get obsessed with stuff like that too, and I just make it take a long time. And then I'm not the one who does final product, and you would never listen to the final product. So.